So would like to call the meeting to order. The first item is the approval of the agenda for today's meeting. The agenda was distributed beforehand, and I'd like to entertain a motion to approve the agenda. Anyone to second that motion? Do we have any discussion regarding the agenda? Okay, we'll call that a balk. A runner goes to second. Okay, I need a vote to approve the agenda. All in favor, please say aye. Any opposed? The agenda is approved. The next item is the approval of the draft minutes for September 18th, 2018, as distributed online via Appendix A that was sent out via the link. Are there any, is there a motion to approve the draft minutes?
If I may make a comment, I did receive some additional requests from some student representatives to include some statements that were made at that meeting, and I have agreed to do that. So they will be revised and sent out again.
Great. I'll discuss the matter of the minutes a little further during my remarks. Do we have a second of the motion to approve the minutes? Thank you. All in favor of approving the minutes as amended, according to Dr. Hoppenstein's remarks, please say aye. Any opposed? Okay, the draft minutes are now the official minutes. In the absence of Interim President Engler, we'll move on to remarks from Dr. Hewitt.
Thank you. Just a couple of updates on some initiatives. I think some of the leadership in the room heard some of this yesterday, but let me just briefly highlight three things, and only because I am sharing the information, but also inviting the participation of anyone in the room who is interested in any of these. As many of you know, at the beginning of this year, Dr. High Fitzgerald, who led the University Outreach and Engagement unit for many years, retired. And with that transition, there's an opportunity, really a need, I think, given the time that's passed, to look at outreach and engagement on our campus and to ask the question, how will faculty and the work of our students need to be supported over the next 20 years? How do we think about outreach and engagement as a university? How has our outreach mission changed, our techniques for outreach? What does real partnership mean in our communities, and what kind of support do we need in order to foster those partnerships? So we're beginning to do a review of outreach and engagement that will involve conversations across campus, probably a survey, an electronic survey that will go out. So when you get that, please respond. And there's currently a steering committee that's organizing the review. They're not responsible for conducting the entire review nor creating a set of specific recommendations, but they are guiding the process. And so if you have interest in being more fully involved in that review process, if you'll let me know, or Karen Klomperens, or Dr. Sonia Gunnings-Moten in the College of Education. They'll be happy to bring you into that conversation earlier rather than later. A second piece of work that is going on is around international students and their experience on our campus. And this particular group is actually creating a network of all of those offices on campus that are doing things, people in places that are working on the student experience, from student advising within the colleges to how we're managing housing, orientation, and the off-campus life of our students. And we're focusing at a first level on our Chinese students, since they represent the largest international population on our campus. Amanda Idema in the College of Engineering is organizing that network. And so if you have interest in being part of that, again, this is really a network. It's not a report, although what they are doing is as they discover either gaps in the kinds of things that we're doing or needs around change, they're making sure that that gets in the right places so that we can begin to make those changes or fill those needs. So that's our international student experience. The final one I'll highlight today is something that has been going on now for about a year, and many of you have been involved in this, but it's very open, and so I invite you, if you've not been asked to talk about it, to participate if you'd like. And that's thinking about an arts and culture strategy for our entire campus. If you think about what the student experience should be and what Michigan State University is to our community, you understand that arts and culture should play a very large part in the life of individuals who are at a comprehensive university where we really value the liberal arts and liberal education, no matter what your field of study. And increasingly, we're understanding the linkages between the arts and other areas, whether it's engineering or mathematics or science. And so we have been thinking for the last year on how we bring together the assets of the university and what kinds of experiences we would like, particularly for students to have, and what the implications are of that for the use of space and extracurricular activities and curricular activities. So Judith Stoddard, who is helping coordinate our arts access across campus, is one of several people who's working on this. We have several deans in the room as well, Dr. Esquith and Forger and Dean Long and Dr. David are all deans who are also helping to drive this. But again, this is a open invitation for those of you who have been thinking about this or who would like to be part of conversations where we are thinking about it to get involved. So that's three of many things, but I wanted to offer those publicly because they're all in different phases of process, but all very much open to any and all who are interested in helping us work toward, I think, three things that could make a significant difference for the lives of our students and faculty and staff on campus.
Thank you. I just want to put on the record that I've just realized that the word art is right in the middle of Spartan. So we'll keep that in mind. All right. To lead into my remarks, what I want to do first is let people know that we have a new way of voting, and I want to outline that with Gary's help at this point. We're using a website called Poll Everywhere that allows us to compose questions and receive anonymous votes either via your laptop or your cell phone via the text function. We'll probably just jump in and do that. You know, it's fairly self-explanatory, but just like, you know, when you say that to your students, that's not always the case. So we'll give some extra time on that first vote to make sure we're using it properly and to field if we're having, no, I can't get in. We'll deal with it then. The other thing I want to mention today is we've had requests for adding lots of things to the minutes and people wanting their remarks included in full. And what we're finding is that the minutes are becoming hours and becoming days and not being minutes. So we do take an audio recording of every meeting that is then transcribed by text recognition software. We're happy to provide that full readout. It's about 50 or 60 pages to anyone who requests it. We could even consider, if people are amenable, just putting that full readout online, having that be available. Could I have caveat there is we're not going to spend lots of time going in and fixing the unavoidable errors in spelling or in terms of words or grammar that may not be fixed by the software. We're not going to make a big, huge production out of it. So if people are willing to accept that we're going to put that readout as is, as generated by the text recognition software, we can do that. And maybe we'll just take a quick show of hands on whether people agree with that. I see nods. Anybody opposed to putting the full readout online? Okay, so that's something we can do moving forward that will supplement but not eliminate the minutes. And this allows us to keep the minutes minute, as the intent of that word is, just to capture highlights of the discussion and the topics for the discussion.
And if I could add, too, then presenting the full readout will allow those who want their voice heard specifically, it'll allow them then to have that available, too, as well.
Yes. Okay, so thanks for that. We're going to move on to new business, given the stacked agenda that we have. I'm going to ask Professor McTell to come to the mic and deliver the information item out of UCC.
Hi, Marcy Mechtel, College of Nursing. As approved by Faculty Senate last week, they approved the following UCC report. For new courses, there are actually no new programs. For program changes, there's 18 and no deletions. With that, there are 51 new courses, 60 course changes, and 33 course deletions. For moratoriums that were approved, a moratorium extension in creative writing minor, effective fall 2017 through summer 2020, moratorium in food safety and toxicology, a graduate certificate approved effective spring, just that one semester, spring of 2019. Moratorium in food safety, graduate specialization, effective spring 2019 to summer 2019. A moratorium extension in quantitative biology, dual major PhD, approved effective spring 2018 to spring 2021. And a moratorium in religion in America's minor, effective fall 18 through fall 2019.
Thank you. The ice cream truck is apparently here. All right, next up we have Professor Moriarty that's going to present a proposal regarding the Presidential Search Committee.
So I'm sure that many of you recall that at the last University Council meeting, we had two of the trustees here, the chairs of the Presidential Search Committee. And at that point, it was brought up that it might be possible to have the four members of the Board of Trustees who are on the Presidential Search Committee have voice but not vote in terms of moving people forward into the final stage. And then the final stage is just the Board of Trustees voting on it. So the motion is a little bit of background. I'm sure you can all read. It's in appendix, but I'll read it anyway so that it's in the record in the minutes. In standard MSU search committee practice, search committees typically do not include the final decision maker. For example, the dean is not a voting member of the search committee. The search committee delivers a list of qualified candidates to the dean with recommendations. The dean then chooses and forwards a final recommendation to the provost. The University Council would like to propose that the Presidential Search Committee follow this accepted MSU practice. The trustees on the Presidential Search Committee thus would be ex officio members of the Search Committee with voice, but would not be voting members of the Search Committee. The other members of the Search Committee would vote on which candidates to forward to the board. Then the full board would select the top choice for president as per their constitutional responsibility. In other words, the board members who are on the search committee would be non-voting members of the search committee, but voting members of the board as a whole in the final decision. This procedure preserves the voice of the four board members on the search committee and also preserves the responsibility of the board as a whole to choose the next president, but eliminates the double voting, which is contrary to standard MSU search committee practice and therefore reduces some of the consternation among MSU community at what is a conflict of interest. So I'm presenting that as a motion. It was voted on in Faculty Senate, where it passed, and would like to also
57-0
with one person abstaining. And I'd like to present this as a motion today and to have the University Council weigh in on it.
Do we have some discussion on the issue? In the absence of any discussion, we will move to an electronic vote through Poll Everywhere. So Gary will initiate it. That's the UCC one. That's the wrong one. Yep. Second one. There you go. Okay. So you can use your texting device and you send the text acad.gov to that number on the screen, and then after acad.gov you put A, B, or C, whether approve, disapprove, or abstain. You can also, if you have a laptop or choose to do the same on your cell phone, go to pollev.com/acad.gov. Gary, could I ask that you turn on black screen until the vote is finished? Or then we can't see. Okay, so. There we go.
And we'll give you some extra time here, obviously. As
you don't have to use a real name. We have 38 entries, 40 entries. If anybody's having technical issues, please raise your hand and we'll try to help you out.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Is someone who has successfully done this help out your colleagues who may be struggling?
Okay.
Are you a good now? We have 53 votes in.
We have a couple people that have just checked in, so maybe we could give an extra minute or two.
Sure.
Okay, thank you, because I do want to bounce some time.
We now have 61. Dr. Rafoli, are you okay? I'm getting there. Okay. This is something new, so we'll leave this open for a bit. We're up to 76 responses. Sherry, what is the total number of people who've signed into the meeting? 91. If anybody's having trouble submitting their vote, please raise your hand and a colleague near you can help you. Yes. Huh? 96. Okay. So we're shy 17 people who have vote at this meeting. We do, if you don't wish to vote yes or no, there is an abstain option. But we would like to have a record of the vote of everyone who's entitled to vote here at University Council. We're shy 13 people. Getting there? Please ask, if you are struggling with this, please ask your neighbor. It's all good. We ask, you know, this is the active learning part of the session. Could do a little think, pair, share activity. Okay, we're shy 11 people now. Okay, we have 10 more votes to be recorded. Okay. So people might think that it has been processed. Okay. Okay. Yep. Okay. Hey, we're up to 91. Well, how about another 30 seconds? Not during the vote.
Not during the vote.
All right, 15 more seconds. Okay, time's up. Gary, please end the vote, and let's see the results. So it's 96% to, it's hard, do you have... If you click on that, what do we see?
Does not. Oh, it. Here are the percentages down here. So it's.
Looks like 96% to 3% to 1%.
Pretty close.
Yeah. Okay. What's that? We have a comment. Dr. Dunn, please go to the mic. Yes.
Please identify yourself, too. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Melissa Dunn. I'm from the College of Education. I just had a question about this voting procedure, and that might be what our student representative was going to bring forward as well, which is that these meetings are open to the public, and we do not each have unique URLs, so anyone who is in the room can vote right now, even if they are not a voting member of University Council.
So that is something that we will take under advisement in moving forward.
At this point, we have to rely on the integrity of observers to not weigh in via vote if you are not a member of the University Council of Michigan State, but we will look into potential options to mitigate that concern.
Can I have one more?
Yes.
Colin Wiebrecht, ASMSU. It's also possible you can vote from your phone, your computer, and the app. All anonymously, so that's another issue as well.
And yeah. Again, we're going to rely on the integrity of the members of the University Council at Michigan State to take their one designated vote and use it whichever method. We do acknowledge that concern, and we will look into ways of mitigating that moving forward. Thank you for the concerns. And Dr. Hewitt.
One other one. I've used this many times, but I have used it in the context of polling, not voting. So will this report the N rather than the percentages? Because if we have 96, it becomes pretty clear, but...
Oh, it says total results 89. I'll put that in.
But not... But, yeah. But it doesn't say the number who voted yes, no, or abstentions. And this time it's easy, but it may not always... We can always see who won, but reporting the end, unless someone, I mean, if Paul's always here, he can calculate for us, but it's not voting software, it's polling software. And so if it will show an end, I think that might be advisable for the minutes.
Dr. Dulabone, would you like to make a comment at the mic?
Just another issue. Total results before were 91, then they dropped to 89. Now
they're
90.
So,
okay. It works great for polling, I'm just telling you.
All right, so we acknowledge that there are concerns, and we'll take them up at steering committee and with academic governance. Dr. Largent.
Mark Largent, Interim Associate Provost for Undergraduate Education. This process turns every vote into a secret ballot. There was no motion on the floor for this to be decided by secret ballot. I don't think it's a valid outcome.
I think the I'll ask the head parliamentarian, can the leadership of steering committee slash university council just decide at an executive level that a vote would be secret ballot?
Technically, no, it is not a secret ballot.
Okay. So we would like to move forward on this issue and not tie ourselves into knots, given the consensus of the university council. So I have an idea that I'd like to float. We did a show of hands at Faculty Senate to record this vote. And given that we're not going to have people putting up two hands, we hope, maybe let's revert to that. Let's discard the electronic vote here. And I'm going to make a motion to have a show of hands vote on this. Dr. Esquith. I think we can say that we had an electronic consensus via polling software, but the actual vote we will have by show of hands. Second of my motion? A voice vote in favor of a show of hands vote. Secret handshake. Any opposed? So we will now take a show of hands vote as recorded by the Secretary of Academic Governance regarding the proposal that Dr. Moriarty read and is now entered into the record. In favor, yes. Okay, so we have 99 in favor. Okay, 94. We have 94 affirmative votes. Do we have any nays? Please raise your hand. Do we have any abstentions? Please raise your hand. Thank you. The motion carries. 94-0-0. Next up, we have a matter on discipline and dismissal of tenured faculty, and this will be presented by Professor Fleck, who is the chairperson of the University Committee on Faculty Affairs. This is a joint proposal with the University Committee on Faculty Tenure.
Right. Thank you. The issue that we're addressing is a decision by the Board of Trustees back in the summer, this past summer, to in effect alter the policy that had been in place with regard to the dismissal of tenured faculty. The primary changes that they wished to make over the objections of the two committees earlier on in the spring was that if an individual chose to go forward after being after beginning the process of dismissal, then and they got to this like final step, then they would be putting at risk some benefits associated with retirement, and they would not be allowed to take retirement. They would have to go through the rest of the dismissal process. So those are the two major concerns that were raised, plus the process. So we have a letter that we have written to the members of the Board of Trustees, which I will quickly read. The University Committee on Faculty Affairs and the University Committee on Faculty Tenure have reviewed the changes made by the Board to the discipline and dismissal of tenure faculty policy. We have several reservations to those changes as I'm going to present them. First, this is not an example of shared or respectful governance. On the contrary, the board chose to approve these changes without meaningful consultation with the individuals directly affected by this policy, namely faculty in the tenure system. After the Board of Trustees received an overwhelming vote of no confidence from the faculty at MSU, this decision appears to demonstrate a lack of foresight and judgment that we find deeply troubling. Recent events at our university should not become an excuse to ignore the basic principles of collegiality and shared governance on which this institution was founded. The recent events that, of course, they're referring to have to do with Dean Strample, and that was the particular issue or the concern that got lots of publicity and that was of concern to the board in terms of how that would be publicly received. And so this is the context for which that particular change in policy occurred. Secondly, we are concerned that these policy changes empower the university president to withhold pay from a member of the faculty without consultation or oversight. We believe that representatives of faculty governance should be involved in any such decisions and that they should not proceed at the sole discretion of the president. Third, likewise, we are concerned that these changes may encourage the faculty at risk of dismissal to retire before a thorough investigation can proceed. Given recent failures in the investigatory process at MSU, we are reluctant to approve a policy that may have the unintended consequence of burying or obscuring serious breaches of behavior and ethics. Given these reservations, UCFA and the University Committee on Faculty Tenure are unwilling to approve these changes as they have been presented to us. We invite members of the board's Committee on Academic Affairs, namely Trustees Byram, Kelly, Lyons, and Moselem, to meet with the committee in, or its representatives in an effort to build a genuine consensus about any changes to the discipline and dismissal of tenure faculty policy. Alternatively, we would welcome a sustained dialogue with the board about these and other policy-related issues that directly affect faculty at MSU. And I'll just add one other point to make it clear. One of the things that was most objectionable was that the president of the university would have the right to withhold pay while this dismissal process was occurring, and there were no criteria set forth for determining this faculty member who's up for dismissal would have their pay withheld, this other faculty member would not have their pay withheld. And in addition, we could not find any other Big Ten universities that had as a matter of policy this business of withholding pay from individuals who were at risk for dismissal.
Thank you. So the motion would be to present this letter to the board with the approval of University Council. So do I have a motion to send this matter to the board?
So
second? Is there any discussion that would like people would like to enter into the record? Dr. Kaplowitz.
Michael Kaplowitz, College of Ag and Natural Resources. I'm wondering, or I believe at Faculty Senate, we discussed a motion to amend the policy and revert to the policy that preceded the change.
Yes.
And I'm not interpreting what just happened as that motion.
Thank you. Well, we can we have a friendly amendment to put that in, that we strongly urge the board to revert back to the original discipline and dismissal of tenured faculty policy as of spring 2018. Right. Do you accept that as a friendly amendment?
Yes, I accept that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you. That is now added to the motion. Thank you, Dr. Kaplowitz. We have a second of the amended motion. Any further discussion? Okay, we'll do once again. Yes. Please identify yourself.
Kathy Petroni from the Broad College of Business. I don't have a problem with us reverting back if we don't like what the board is suggesting, but I think it's really important that this policy does get thoroughly reexamined. The way the policy works now, if we had a faculty member that came to campus and shot 10 people, that faculty member would continue to be paid until it took a year, year and a half for us to get through our process. I personally think that that's not right, and that there should be certain situations where what the person has done is serious enough that something needs to be done to either speed up the process. It's just, in my mind, the process right now is not good. So that's just my opinion.
Thank you. Do you have any further comment? Dr. Hunt. Oh, Dr. Moriarty first, and then Dr. Hunt. And Dr. Borsila. Who got to the mic first? All right.
Sorry.
This process would be a two-step process. The first step of the process would be to revert to the old bylaws. The second step of the process would be to follow what the letter said, which is to examine the policy and to meet with the board and to talk about what the policy and what changes would need to be made. So it is a two-step process. It's just simply a matter of making sure that we revert to the old bylaws before we... It takes a long time to change things. So the change could take a long time. Very, yeah.
Dr. Borsila?
I'm in very strong support of the letter and the motion. And I imagine that faculty on UCFT as well as faculty on UCFA are very mindful of what needs to be done, but also the process is, this is academic governance, and I know that we can move fast on this, but we generate those bylaws for governance that then the board approves. So I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
Dr. Hunt had a comment.
I was advised by Professor Hoppenstein before the meeting that the substitution role that I have does not involve vote, so I didn't vote on the last item, and I'm not going to vote on this one. However, it strikes me that in addition to the concerns which were expressed by Professor Fleck and the subsequent speakers, there is an additional concern that the council might wish to address within the context of whatever it does, and that is that there is a reason that the provost, as the chief academic officer, typically brings forward recommendations concerning personnel in the academic ranks. And one of the rationales for that role for the provost is that there is nothing that guarantees that any given president will be a member of the academic staff. And I've served here long enough to be under presidents who were and under presidents who were not. But the provost is a member of the academic staff always, and is subject to the selection process established by Taylor II and the periodic review process that involves all members of the academic community under Taylor II, and has direct accountability as an academic colleague to academic colleagues. So I would suggest respectfully that the council consider whether the absence of the role of the provost vis-a-vis the second bullet is not in itself problematic.
Yes.
Could any future speakers try to speak into the mic just for the record?
Thank you. Dr. Doodlebon?
Yeah, in light of the concern of the second part about moving forward and changing the bylaws, would it be more appropriate, do you think, to say instead of we invite members that we request members of the board's committee on academic affairs to meet with the committee?
Dr. Fleck, would you consider that a friendly amendment?
I'd accept it as a friendly amendment.
Thank you. Yep, we need a second and a vote to approve that change. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Just the change. Okay. Now, is there any further discussion, or would Dr. Hewitt like to comment on the matter raised by Dr. Hunt?
No, I think what Dr. Hunt suggested is a conversation for the future as we rethink the points that have been made. Assuming that we revert back to the language as it was, it sounds as if there's an interest in a very serious conversation about how to move forward in. We heard the extreme example, but we know it's a continuum, and so how do we make those decisions reasonably? So I think putting that in that conversation is the right context.
Okay. So now we have a final vote to send that letter as with the friendly amendments to the board. As in addition, a thorough discussion at UCFT and UCFA in consultation with the board in a shared governance fashion to after the policies are reverted back to craft new policies that address further concerns about illegal or immoral behavior. So I think we'll now call the vote.
Would you like the electronic polling?
No,
version?
We will. To use a British term, bin the electronic polling, and we will move to a show of hands. But maybe count people in segments so that you know our old arms don't have to be up in the air for a long time. All right. So please, all in favor of the motion. Please raise your hands. Yeah. No, Dr. Hoppenstein will count. Only this, everyone else can relax. You got me?
I got you.
I votes. Nay votes. Please raise your hand. Abstentions, please raise your hand. Thank you. The motion carries. Next up, we're going to have each of the four major party candidates for MSU Board of Trustees who are on the November ballot. We're going to try to have this fair here. We'll start off in alphabetical order. So we'll go to Mr. Dave Dutch, who is one of the Republican candidates. Please come to the mic. We recognize you and grant you voice. Oh, yeah, he can have a seat here. That's also, unless, do you have stuff to project on the screen?
Dave Dutch, candidate for MSU trustee this November 6th. Can everyone hear me? I'm good to go. I'd like to spend, if it's okay, a few minutes introducing myself, I think, and tell you why I'm running. I think each of the candidates will do that, and then we can go to questions. I was born and raised in East Lansing. My dad, Tom Dutch, worked at the university 52 years. I think many of you in this room may know him or know of him. I'm one of 10 kids and spent much of my younger years at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Great upbringing. It still warms my heart when I think about it. I went away to school, United States Naval Academy, came back after 10 years and got my MBA at the Broad School with my wife. She completed her degree, undergrad degree, at Michigan State in communications in 1997, along with my MBA in finance in 1997. And then I spent 20 years in the corporate world. But Michigan State is near and dear to me. I bleed green, you know, with eight of the 10 kids in my family have 1 or 2 degrees from this family. I've worked on this campus as a kid. I worked as a GA, Bob Monska and Don Bowersox, for both of them. I have, my sisters have worked, or still do, one of them, at the university. I'm very intimate with the importance of Michigan State University and the role it plays in this community, in this state, and in the world, really. We're the, one of the schools that feeds the world. And I just love it so much, and I love the folks. You know, I have a lot of relationships with people on campus, and I want to be part of the solution going forward. So I bring that up because I think it is very important that how much I care about this university. And that's one of the big reasons I feel compelled to run for trustee this cycle. That's coupled with the fact that I did spend 20 years in business. I've worked for large and small companies. I've been an entrepreneur. I have served on boards. I've reported to boards. I actually served on the Broad College School Board, Alumni Board for 7 years. I'm a past president. I understand the unique attributes of a university and what it takes, you know, much different than the corporate world. I worked with Bob Duncan most of that time, and I've worked with Sanjay recently, too, going forward. So I'm very familiar with the MSU and the difference between an academic organization versus a corporate organization. So I think those two things make me uniquely qualified to be a trustee this cycle. I think we've gone through some of the darkest times nationally and locally that our university has ever seen. And I think there's a lot of trust debt right now with our board and you know, our leadership. And I want to be part of the solution going forward. I actually have 3 kids here also, current Spartans. We have 3 generations in my family of Spartans. I want 4 at some point, too. And I want to continue this, continue helping this university be what has fundamentally changed my life and made me who I am and as successful as I've been. Is, you know, I chalk up to Michigan State and East Lansing. So that's kind of, that is who I am and why I'm running, and I feel it's very, very important. I think the board needs a different skill set, different mindset, and it needs to build back some trust with people that really care about this university. And I would make I'm sensitive to my other trustee candidates. Do you want me to go through Q&A first, or should they?
Yeah, what we're going to have is we'll have a couple, 3 questions from the audience for each candidate as they come up. So okay. What we, you know, please don't have like 19 follow-up questions. And I know we're academics and we like to ask 6 questions in one. You know, that's how we write our tests, right? So we have a few questions from the audience for Mr. Dutch.
Yes.
I acknowledge Dr. Moriarty. Oh. And then come on up. Come. Yeah. You can go up. Yeah. I'll have Dr. Moriarty first.
This is a question I would like to ask to everyone who is running for the Board of Trustees. Last year, we had an unprecedented vote of no confidence in the Board of Trustees by the faculty. What would you do in the instance where there was a vote of no confidence in the Board of Trustees? What would your reaction be?
I'd be embarrassed, number one, if I were on the Board of Trustees. And, you know, I was not at the table. I cannot speak for them. We talked about this as a group of candidates. I am surprised that they did not take action on their own, to be honest. It's our president stepped down, and the 8 trustees that provided oversight are still there. And I do think I struggle with that, and I'm sure they do too. But I wasn't at the table. I think I would have resigned, to be honest.
Mr. Hawkins?
You. Isaiah Hawkins. Excuse me. Isaiah Hawkins, ASMSU and the College of Music. I'm glad to hear that from you. That ties into my question as well. So for those that don't know, ASMSU hosted a few weeks ago now. Time moves, whatever. ASMSU hosted a trustee candidate forum where all the 4 candidates, I got the opportunity to witness you all speaking there, and I enjoyed that opportunity. At that event, there was a comment made by you, I'm sure you remember, that when the question of shared governance was brought up, you responded that governance cannot be shared. And I wanted to take a moment, before asking my question, I want to take a moment to say that this is shared governance. There are many academic governance committees as subsets of university council, and before you get to university council, not to mention faculty senate, ASMSU, COGS, numerous constituent groups, shared governance is reaching out to them. So taking stock of the no confidence vote that was passed by faculty last semester and saying that the university needs leaders that will bring the different perspective up to the board of trustees and to that level of administration, to what extent are you committed to recognizing that the way to make change is to get these voices and these opinions in the room and seeing that the experience of people in this room and the people they represent are what make up Michigan State University?
Well, first of all, thank you for the question, because I'd like to clarify. What I was answering at the time, and the thought was, do we add students, faculty, and or staff to the Board of Trustees? And what I was responding to is formal voting members. There's been, and I don't believe in that, and it's, as a matter of fact, it's part of our Constitution. Even if I believed in that, it's not possible without a constitutional change. I believe in shared governance in the sense of, you know, inclusive, open communication forums like this. I think this is what makes this university tick. So I'm not contrary to what you heard there, but there has been two different discussions, one about changing the makeup of the board, which would require, depending on who you talk to, a constitutional amendment, and shared governance is groups like this and formal and informal interactions with students, you know, undergrad, graduate, faculty and staff, which I am a huge supporter of. I think that's how information gets shared. That's how good decision-making gets done. And I'm a huge proponent of that. But at this point, I'm not for a change in the Board of Trustees because I think it's a constitutional amendment would be needed.
Ms. Shamut, do I have your name right?
My name is Mesa Sitar. Okay. I'm with ASMSU, and I'm a representative for the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences. And my question actually kind of ties into what you were just talking about. Last year, there was a really big push for having a student member of the Board of Trustees. As you possibly know, most Big Ten universities have a student representative. And, you know, as you stated, it is a constitutional amendment. And so that would have to be passed. But say that it was passed, would you support it? And then the second part of my question is, if such a constitutional amendment is not passed, would you support having like a second tier of the board in some sense? I don't know if you've heard that proposal.
I've heard that proposal. Thank you for the question. So to the first point, absolutely. If there's a constitutional amendment, I'm all about following the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, the Constitution of our state as it was written. So I would support, you know, whatever the voters of Michigan chose to do. So our Constitution said students on the board, the Constitution says that. If it says faculty staff on the board, it's what it says. Right now it says 8 members, you know, through the election process in our state. So absolutely, I'll support whatever the citizens of Michigan vote for their representatives to do as far as law. The Constitution. Without that, I am very receptive and have done in my own company. So I've served as an auditor of the board when I was a student getting my MBA here. I participated not in the Board of Trustees, but the board, the alumni board for the Broad College. In my companies, we've had staff and management participate and sit in with board meetings, some ad hoc, some rotating, things like that. And I think there is a way to do that. Now, there will come time where you need to have a voting session or an executive session. And I think that's appropriate and the privilege of the board. And there are very sensitive things and conflicts of interest and names that shouldn't be shared. There's a lot of reasons. But, yeah, I'm totally receptive to having some level of board participation, you know, from the university at large. I think that's more than appropriate, especially given what we've gone through recently.
Thank you, Mr. Dutch. Let's move on. We're going to alternate party and go in order of alphabetical order. So I'm going to ask Ms. Brianna Scott to come and provide a few remarks about her candidacy.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Brianna. Can you hear me okay?
My name is Brianna Scott. I am from Muskegon, Michigan, born and raised. I am a product of public school education. I graduated from Mona Shores High School in Muskegon, Michigan, and I like to tell people that at the time when I graduated from Mona Shores High School, it's a Class A school, very large, if you haven't heard of it, in West Michigan. It was before schools of choice, and so I was in a predominantly white school where I really didn't get to grow up or see teachers or anybody like that looked like me until I came to Michigan State. When I got here, it was very exciting for me as a person of color to actually finally, for the first time in my life, see other people from different walks of life, different cultures, ethnicities, to actually have TAs and professors that looked like me and people in powerful professional positions. So right off the top, when I got to Michigan State, I was extremely impressed by the diversity that was here. However, while at Michigan State, at the age of 20, I ended up getting pregnant. It was not immaculate conception, but it was a really horrible time in my life. If you talk about depression, I was super depressed. Age of 20, unwed. My father was the public health director in the county that I came from, and he had gone around since the time that I was in ninth grade talking about abstinence and safe sex. And so I was like the black sheep of the family coming at that time. So I considered dropping out of school. I was working two jobs. I had a work study on campus in the Eli Broad Business College Library and off campus in an externship. I was barely making ends meet, and so I decided at the conclusion of the semester I was going to leave Michigan State and go back to Muskegon, Michigan. However, it was because of people like you all here in this room, my professors, my TAs, my both bosses on campus and off campus, talking to me and saying to me that if you go home, Brianna, you probably will never come back to Michigan State, that I did not leave. They helped me to find the additional financial aid and scholarships, actually helped me to find off-campus housing because I was living in Wilson Hall at the time. Both of my bosses saved my job for me while I was off during my pregnancy and after giving birth. And I also pledged a sorority while I was on campus, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated. I had just been voted in as my chapter president here on campus, and they would not allow me to resign. They said that I would show people what perseverance looked like and that I was actually going to be able to make it, and they were going to help me through this. And they threw me three baby showers, so I didn't have to buy a thing for the child that I had here. So I give so much credit to MSU for where I'm at today, because I know had I gone back, I probably would not have graduated from college, let alone this wonderful university. And it was also because of a professor that I had, a business law professor, who encouraged me to actually go to law school that I became an attorney. So I give a lot of credit for even professionally where I'm at today. I went back after graduating from Wayne State University Law School to Muskegon. I became the first person of color to ever work in the Muskegon County Prosecutor's Office, where I handled any type of case you could imagine. Some of them were very difficult cases, if you can only imagine. And during my last year there, I had been promoted to start working in the Criminal Sexual Conduct Investigative Unit, where I handled criminal sexual conduct cases as a prosecutor, working with the CSC committee to evaluate those cases and working as an advocate for victims. I had too much for my stomach in that, and I decided to leave the criminal prosecution practice and go into private practice, which I did. 2005, I started my own law firm. I am a successful entrepreneur of two other businesses in addition to my law firm that employs five people full time. In Muskegon, I have been extremely involved in issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion. I am the first person of color to ever be the president of our Muskegon Rotary Club. And I say that that was quite an accomplishment because that club was mostly white men who saw something in me to let me lead them. And it's one of the largest Rotary Clubs here in the state of Michigan. The child that I got pregnant with at the age of 20 is now an engineering major right here at Michigan State University. He is the only child that I've ever had, so I'm extremely proud of him. But because of him, I am spending a lot of money to this university, and I am very concerned with the cost of the rising cost of tuition, because every semester it seems like there's more money coming out of my pocket. And as a person who has the ability to pay out of pocket for tuition, I understand that I'm blessed. But I do know that we have people that are from the lower middle income families that are struggling in order to send their children here or to come here themselves. And I think about me as a non-traditional student and how hard it was for me to graduate and to afford my college education. So the issues of affordability are very important to me, and I feel that Michigan State has not done a good job to control the cost of our rising cost of tuition and education here. So that is a very big issue for me. I talk a lot. I'm an attorney. Sorry.
Okay. We would like to get the question.
Okay. So I'm just briefly, I would also say that as an ex-prosecutor, I was just appalled at what I saw when I actually sat next to Professor Andaluna Bercia at the April, I think it was 13th, Board of Trustee meeting, and that was the reason I decided to run for the MSU Board of Trustees. The way that the victims and their families and the faculty and staff were treated by our interim president was very disturbing. I was not happy with the lack of compassion and the lack of empathy that was shown to the survivors, and I feel that we can do better. I think that we need to have different voices on our Board of Trustees, and there is no one on the board currently that looks like me or who was poor and on welfare and financial aid assistance coming out of college with over $100,000 worth of debt that I'm still paying for, who can really understand the issues that our current students are suffering from, and who also feels the importance of being engaged with not just our students, but the faculty and staff on this campus. So I believe that I am uniquely qualified in my background and my experiences. I think that I will bring a very unique perspective to the Board of Trustees that is needed, and I am hoping to get your support. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time
for one or two questions from members of University Council. Dr. Johnson and Dr. Moriarty.
Jennifer Johnson, College of Human Medicine. So I was interested in your reason that you said you ran at the Board of Trustees meeting. You didn't like how the faculty were treated. What, as a board member, would you do to treat faculty differently and students differently, and in particular, all the same shared governance as we asked the previous candidate, governance questions? What does shared governance mean to you, and how far are you willing to go to share decision-making with the faculty, staff, and students?
Well, in short, I did sign the Reclaim MSU, I forgot what it was called, but it was some agreement that was requested of the candidates back about 2 months ago to sign, indicating whether or not we felt that we should have representation on the Board of Trustees from the faculty, staff, and student population, and I am in favor of that in answer to that question. As it relates to the engagement, I feel that the Board of Trustees is kind of, as I've heard other candidates say, been in an ivory tower. I think even as a student, for me, I don't really remember who they were. And I think that that's a problem. You all are our key stakeholders. The students, the faculty and staff that walk this campus every day, you know best what this university needs. And if we're not talking with you and really engaging to get your input, then how do we know that the decisions that we are making are going to be the best for you? And so one of the things that I had discussed throughout my candidacy is that I would like to do a quote-unquote town hall, but like a dorm hall. And I would also like to go from, you know, all of the dorms, the neighborhoods, talking, letting you know I'm going to have a meeting. It's open. It's a forum in this capacity where people can answer questions and have those questions answered. And also going into the departments and talking to the faculty and staff about the issues that you all are seeing in your departments and the things that you feel are needed in order to do the best that you can with your curriculum and the things that you're teaching. So I believe that that engagement will start to build on that process.
I'll repeat my question, yes. In the event of a vote of no confidence by the faculty, what would your reaction be?
Are you asking if I were on the Board of Trustees at that time, or if it happens if I get on the Board of Trustees in the future?
If you were on the Board of Trustees and if you get on the Board of Trustees in the future.
Well, I feel strongly that we are elected officials. I love the fact that these positions are elected, and we therefore are responsible to our constituency. And if those of you that are the key stakeholders here on campus feel that you have no confidence in me, I think it's hard to work effectively with that type of feedback. And so I would say that I would resign. I would be sad to do that. I would hope that I could convince people that I am capable of making the differences that or the changes that you would be wanting to happen, but I do feel that your voice should be heard, and I certainly would not want to buck the grain.
Thank you. We'll move on now to, thank you, Ms. Scott. Oh, yeah. Quick. Yes. Is this a question for Ms. Scott? Okay, so you're back on the hot seat. Sorry.
Thanks so much for being here. Anda Luna Borchila, James Madison College. Thanks very much for being here. I just want to ask you if you get elected to the board, would you commit to pushing for an open presidential search as we endorsed on Senate, meaning more specifically and on Reclaim, that the top candidates meet with our community in public forums?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Did you cut my mic off?
Oh, I didn't.
Oh. Does that mean I'm talking too much? Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, now we'll move on to Mr. Mark Miller, Republican candidate for Board of Trustees. Can have either seat.
It's Mike.
Mike, I'm sorry, my bad. Mike Miller, for the record.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you all for allowing us to come and to speak with you. This is an honor and a privilege to be in front of such an august body. I must say that I get very nervous being in front of a bunch of professors. I think, especially when I think I'm taking a test. So it makes me even more nervous. It reminds me of many years ago. I once said that I was on campus during the protests of the war, and Kelly Tebe said to me that I didn't realize they protest the Second World War. And I said, no. It was a little later than that. So look, I think that you need to understand that everybody here that's talking to you today is talking about a job that doesn't pay. Okay, there's no reward in this job except for the approval of the people that they work for. I do believe that you know, some of the questions that have been asked have been right on point. You know, should the board have resigned? Great question. Should they have resigned? I don't know the answer to that, other than I know the system is that we elect a board that not only you elect it as citizens, but a whole group of other citizens, 10 million, get together and they decide they're going to elect the board. So the question I guess you'd have to ask yourself is, if they all resigned, would you be happy with a board, the new board that you would have, appointed by Governor Snyder? Show of hands. Would you be happy? Be happy with that board? Would it be better board? We don't know. Well, let's assume that it was a political appointee that you got. So someone that knew the governor and wanted to be a trustee. Because that's what you'd get. You may not know, but that is what you'd get in this system. So the realities are, I don't know that all of those board members should have resigned, knowing that there's an election coming up. I think the two members that are not running are essentially resigning because they could run for re-election. They know they could never get elected, but the realities are they're stepping down. So questions are, how do you want to handle these kinds of challenges? If it were me, and I had a complete vote of no confidence from the people that I worked with this closely, I'd get out of the way. I'd want a different leader. I'd want somebody else that could earn your confidence and bring you where you wanted to be with this university. Look, I've started 9 businesses in my life. 7 of them are still operating. One of them grew to 2,000 employees with 13 plants around the world. It's very successful, and I believe that I got my start from Michigan State University. Now, my brother went to Michigan State. My sister went to Michigan State. I went to Michigan State. My dad went to Michigan State. My daughter went to Michigan State. So we believe in Michigan State. We love Michigan State. I've lived in the Lansing, Okemos, East Lansing area for 60 years. I grew my business here. I understand Michigan. I believe in Michigan. And I believe in Michigan State University. And you know what? I don't like it when people say the culture at Michigan State University stinks. You know why I don't like that? Because I believe that I'm part of that culture because I'm a Spartan. And I believe you're part of that culture. And I don't believe you stink. I believe you care. That's why you're here. I believe Michigan State is a great university. And so for that reason, I don't like it when people say that. I don't like it when I hear alumni say, you know what? I don't put on my Spartan gear anymore because I don't want people to know I was a Spartan. We've had some problems. We've had some serious problems. We've had the greatest tragedy in the history of this university from a public relations perspective. I don't think any of you stopped teaching. I don't think anybody stopped working on our school. I don't think the students gave up their education. I think they kept going. But the realities are we've got to restore the public confidence in Michigan State University. So we've got to get them to know who you are and what your culture really is. I believe that we have got to ferret out the people that were responsible for the tragedy that occurred and remove them. Whoever they are, if they either sponsored or continued and allowed someone to molest people under the guise of medical treatment, they should be gone. It's that simple. Now, I don't know anybody in particular. I know there's an investigation going on by our attorney general. I've spoken with him about that investigation, and he says that he's going to bring it to a completion and that that investigation will tell us who, what, where, and when. Well, that's the best we can do at that point, and then we've got to rebuild. And I want to be part of that rebuilding. I've built businesses. I've built teams. I've hired key people. I've interviewed key people. I've worked in human resources. I've worked in corporate governance. I've worked with big boards and small boards, nonprofit boards, for-profit boards. And I understand that we have to work together as a team. We have to believe in the same things, and that is to provide an elite education with an elite institution. So I have to tell you that this particular tragedy touched me personally. Some of you may know if you've looked at my background or gone to my webpage, I will selfishly say my webpage is Mike Miller, 4 F-O-R M-S-U. And you can read about my background, you can read who I am, you can read that I care about Michigan State. I think that this is a time for us to come together. And I believe that bringing unity back to this university is going to be a key issue. That is going to be determined primarily by who we hire to lead Michigan State University for the next decade. And you should be a part of that. You should be part of who we hire, because whoever that person is going to represent us all as Spartans. And as a board member, I would support your involvement in picking the next president. It's going to be that critical for the next decade. We have huge challenges coming towards us. We have a reduction in high school graduates. We've had tuition increases, and I know he wants me to stop. But I'm not being a prosecutor. We've had tuition increases of 6% a year for the last 15 years. We've had cost of living increases at less than 3%. We can't sustain that and provide an education for working Michigan families.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. We do need to move to questions.
Questions.
You did answer the one about the vote of no confidence. He answered that in his talk. I felt like he answered that.
I'd be happy to answer it again if you'd
Dr.
like
O'Foley?
To ask it again.
Okay, Robert O'Foley, College of Engineering. I guess the question that I want to ask you is that I came to one of our faculty senate meetings, and I was so mad. When I went home, I told my wife I was going to run for the Board of Trustees. Then, as a good faculty member, I started doing some research, and I realized that I don't have a chance in hell, right? Because it is all political. It is all political. Whether you are elected or you are appointed, it's all political. So our two largest political parties control the process. So I want to ask you a different question. Since I cannot do it, would you be willing to encourage your political party to start a process of changing the constitution so the process of electing and retaining trustees can be modified? I think 8 years is a joke. And I know somebody on there who I think started there before the university was even initiated, and he's still there. Okay, so how are you willing to take up that role, that get your political party to say, this is nonsense. We need to do something about this and actually work at changing the process? That's my question.
I think, you know, to be fair, I didn't determine the term length, okay? So I would agree with you. I think 8 years is a long time. And if you're my age, it's even longer, okay? Because I started adding them in dog years. You know, it's like 7 years for every year. So the realities are, I do agree with you, 7 years is a long time. I have never held political office. I have never been a political person in my life, ever. But I sat at meetings where I watched my daughter's teammates cry, where I watched her competitors cry and talk about what had happened to them. And I can tell you right now that that's motivation. If you want to be a candidate, you got to get on the program. I told a student the other day that said, would you support students on the board? And I said, absolutely, man, run for office. I sat in a forum the other day with a student right next to me who was running in the Green Party. So the question is, are you going to tell me now that the Democrats, the two women that are back there, that those aren't good representatives? I think they are. I think they're great young ladies. I think they're fantastic candidates. And they've been through the process. I don't like people having to get a new process learned in order to run, but that's what I had to do. I had to find out, well, how do you become a candidate for trustee? And I went through the process. So I don't think it's as discriminatory or as difficult as you say. There was 11 candidates to be trustees in the Democratic Party. We had four, two dropped out. So the realities are, I think there's people willing. I think students can run. I think faculty members can run. And I think your credentials would probably have been better credentials in it from an educational perspective than mine. What I have is corporate governance experience. So I have that opportunity, but I don't have the experience that you have. So I can only tell you, I didn't establish the process. The Constitution did. And I didn't establish the 8 years. I would agree with you, 8 years is a long time. It takes us 6 years to get rid of 75% of the board. I don't know that that's right. We'll move on
to the next question. Mr. Hawkins.
Check. Isaiah Hawkins, ASMSU and College of Music again. First off, I'd like to say that your passion for this is admirable, and your commitment to MSU as an institution that you have a lot of history for is to be commended, and I really respect that about you. However, after November 6th, and this is for really any of the candidates, whichever two trustees get elected, this turns from the political process, from the election aspect of it, to a responsibility, not just to the 10 million people that vote in the state of Michigan and that aspect of the constituency, but even more so to the over 50,000 people that your actions will affect and your decisions will affect on a direct day-to-day basis. A lot of what I've heard from being at those same Board of Trustees meetings and at University Council meetings for the past year and sitting in the back during Faculty Senate has been seeing And even regarding the Nassar investigation and how and seeing how little that the board of trustees knew, is that there is a direct, there's a direct relationship between the distance between the board of trustees and the campus and the people that live on this campus and explain it and experience it day to day. So my question to you would be, to what extent are you willing to bridge that gap and be on campus on a day-to-day basis and be a part of the everyday governance, be a part of ASMSU meetings, COGS meetings, and really reach out to these constituents to which you hold a direct responsibility?
Well, thanks for asking that question, because it is an opportunity for me. One of the reasons I'm here is I was encouraged by my family to do this because I had retired. I retired from my active service in a company that, I still founded and own. I've retired from that, so I have time. So I have proposed, and you can find it on my webpage, spending Tuesdays with the trustee where I'd have an open office and be ready to go. I would love to attend ASMSU meetings and COGS meetings. Those would be very important to me. I would see that as a learning experience. I don't have recent experience as a student, as one of the candidates is going to come up here and tell you, hey, I have more recent experience than that guy does. That's very true. She does. But the realities are, the experience that I bring is I've run companies where the decisions I made as the CEO affected thousands of people every day.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Okay, we'll move on to Ms. Kelly Tibe, Democratic candidate for Board of Trustees. We will get to you. Don't worry. You're next.
All righty.
Yeah, three people have been on it, so it's hot.
I know.
Yeah, it is.
They warmed it up for me. Hi, I'm Kelly Tibe. I am running for MSU Board of Trustees because I looked at the board and saw that there was not a voice on the board that was not far removed from their time at Michigan State. I graduated from Michigan State with my bachelor's in 2008 and my master's in 2011. What really motivated me is I thought about my time at Michigan State, and I came to Michigan State in 2005 from a small town up in the Thumb. And Michigan State kind of opened a world of opportunity for me. But my freshman year at freshman orientation on the first day, us young women were told that one in four of us was going to be sexually assaulted while we were on campus. And that was the tone that they set for us on day one. And unfortunately for me, I became that statistic my freshman year. So when we're having these conversations about sexual assault on campus, it's personal for me. And I think that it's important to have a voice like that on the board that's truly committed to making sure that no young woman or young man experiences what I did on campus. And I think it's very important that we also, you know, are conscious of, you know, how we're taking care of our survivors of Larry Nassar as well. And so that's truly important to me. But I also think about my time at Michigan State and, you know, the continual culture problems that I think go beyond sexual assault. And our current board members, when they were in college, they were able to work full time in the summer, and that would pay for their tuition in the fall and the spring. And that's not a reality for students anymore. And we are supposed to be a land grant institution that makes it affordable for any student in the state of Michigan that wants to go to college. And that's not a reality anymore. And I think that that's something that as board members, we really need to tackle. It's certainly one of the most important things that students bring up to me on a daily basis. I graduated with $40,000 of debt. I worked while I was in school. I depleted my savings and had help from my parents. And I think I turned out all right, but I'm still paying $400 a month on my student loans. And to have someone on the board that's voting on these decisions that, you know, is still paying their student loans, I think that's important to have someone that understands what it's like to be a student. I have been committed throughout my entire candidacy to kind of opening Michigan State wide open to transparency, accessibility, and accountability. Those are three things that I think our board, they don't have it. And they're not open to it, it doesn't appear. With transparency, I have been saying all along that I want our committee meetings, our presidential search to be open. I want our Open Meetings Act to be actually followed. And so that people are actually have a voice in the room and that our decisions are actually, you know, informed by those that are here on campus every day. With accessibility, I believe that the board members need to be on campus, spending time with the people that are on campus, having conversations with those that are working, with those that are studying. I think that's important, and I think that's something that we're missing from the board right now. And obviously, accountability. It is very clear that they are not accountable to you, and they're not accountable to us as a public, and they're not accountable for the actions that they do and don't make. And I think that's really important for real leadership here at Michigan State, and I think that's something that we need going forward.
Thank you. We have questions from the floor. Dr. Moriarty, she did not answer your question.
She did
so.
Not.
No. In the interest of time, we'll have two questioners. Oh. No, it's fine. One faculty, one student. Thank you. Oh. Or you want to, how do you?
Do you want to answer the question so I don't need to?
Yes, for a vote of no confidence, I would resign. Absolutely. I don't think that if you are a board member and your staff and faculty don't have any faith in you, then you absolutely should resign. So, yes, I would resign.
Dr. Borsella.
Can you? Okay. So I just want to ask, there are a number of people who've said that they would support faculty and students, a couple of people on the board, based on a constitutional amendment, but the Senate has also endorsed the proposal that would ask for faculty and students to be included on a university board and participate in shared governance that way. Are you open to that? And are you open to, kind of committed to an open search process? Thank you.
Absolutely. So actually, one of the things I've been looking into, obviously, we would need a constitutional amendment to add a voting, you know, faculty and student member on the board. And while we're hoping and waiting for a legislature that would be open to it, I will continue to have conversations with both Wayne State and University of Michigan board members to see if they would be open to it. But there are also, as you stated, a lot of other ways for us to involve faculty and students on the board. Wayne State actually does it. They have student members in their committees that are, you know, have rights as committee members, and they put it in their bylaws. And so there are ways around the Constitution that we can have representation. And I am 100% supportive of that. I think that's extremely important for trust of the board, for us moving forward as a community. We need to make sure that voices are being heard. I think this is something that's coming up more and more in government. We need voices at the table, and your decisions need to be informed by the people that you're affecting. And when you lose that, you've lost governance. You've lost your confidence in your board. And I think that's extremely important moving forward.
Thank you.
Hi, Catherine Rafiotis, ASMSU and James Madison College. I think that this question goes for all of the candidates. I don't think you're going to have a chance to answer it right now, but just a food for thought. As you move from being a candidate to being a board member, you no longer can say I, you have to say we. So it's not enough to vote against. You have to convince others to vote with you. So can you tell us a time where you showed that experience of, you know, reaching across the aisle, making compromise, and still making sure you continue to be a strong advocate for the things that you stand for? And then how are you going to, you know, make sure that you start convincing the other board members and moving in that direction? Because I can assure you, you're going to receive pushback from when you get into a collective that has already been well established in its norms and its practices. Thank you.
Absolutely. So offhand, I can't think of an instance that I can give an example, but I can talk about me as a person. And one of the things that I've done over my time working, I work in development. I work in fundraising. It's not an easy job. And there's a lot of different ideas out there on how to do things the right way. But when I think about the Board of Trustees, what I'm hoping to bring to the board as a board member, knowing that I am only one vote on the board, is to make sure that I'm encouraging my fellow board members to be open, to listen. Obviously, with a vote of no confidence, I would hope that at this point in time, they're open and they're listening, because I think that there's going to be, you know, repercussions, obviously, and I think that we're going to get to a point with, unfortunately, because of our long-term limits, every 2 years, we will have to, you know, put them in their place and answer to the public about, you know, whether they're an effective board member anymore. But I think about me as a person and just trying to get people to understand and have conversation. One of the things that I think as a board is that we should not always be committed to having a unanimous vote. I think that that shows that there's not discourse. And I think that it's okay that we disagree sometimes. And I think it's okay to be the person that says, I might be voting no on this. Here's my reason why. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not part of our team of board members. I think that that's something that we're missing. I think that we missed that voice when we voted for our interim president. I was very disappointed to see that it was interim. And then when you have two of your board members come back and say, never mind, we made a mistake. It's like, well, were you having questions about that before you voted? Why was that position unanimous? Because I have trouble believing that that was a unanimous decision. I think that's important. I think that's important with our board, of being more open to having conversations and continuing to have a lot of tough conversations, which I'm thankful for you all that seem to be continuing to bring these tough conversations to the board, because I think that's the only way we change the culture at Michigan State. I will say that we have a culture problem at Michigan State, and I'm committed to working with all of you to change it. I'm not ashamed to say that. I'm still proud to be a Spartan. I still bleed green, but we have a problem, and we have a lot of work to do together to figure out how we fix these problems at Michigan State. And I can't do it alone, so I do need all of you. As a board member, for me to get anything done as a board member, I need support from the faculty and the students and staff, and I can vote with confidence as my one vote if I know that I have confidence from all of you as well. So thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to offer a round of applause for all four candidates. Thank you all for your candor and your unquestioned love of Michigan State University. I'd like to bring Mayor Mark Meadows up to the dais here to discuss the East Lansing City income tax that has that will go into effect on January 1. And we thank the mayor for his patience waiting in the back for so long. Whichever seat you like. Yeah, that one's warm.
That one's warm? Thanks, and thanks for having me. Everybody can hear me? Okay, and I did send in something that could be shown on the screen. I don't know if it came in time so that it could be put up or not.
If you send it to me, we can put it up on the screen.
Okay, it was sent to you, I believe. Probably around 3:45, so just recently. I do have some handouts if anybody wants to look at those.
I don't have it, sir.
No? Okay.
Oh, wait. There it is.
Okay, cool.
Just got it. Okay.
So it'll be helpful if I can use this, and that somebody who actually knows how to change the slides can actually
do
that.
I'll change them for you. Just give me the high sign.
You know, what I was asked to do is come over and talk about the financial situation in the city of East Lansing and the income tax and how it will be utilized to address that situation. So part of this presentation is really about where we were, and hopefully we'll demonstrate where we hope to be over the next few years. And then I'm happy to answer questions from any faculty members about the implementation of the income tax, how we plan on implementing it, and how it may personally affect you. While we're waiting for this to get up, let me ask a couple of questions of the audience. Like, who here works solely in the city of East Lansing at the university? If you can just raise your hands. And others, how about Detroit? Anybody? Flint, yay? Is that Detroit or Flint? Okay, and Grand Rapids. Some medical personnel probably work in Grand Rapids as well. So in implementing the income tax, we do have a number of implementing activities that we've undertaken, and I'll talk about those in a couple of minutes. So this is...
next slide?
Yep, next slide. And I'll go through this relatively quickly because I want to let you know what we have and why we got here. So this first slide is the general fund revenue total for the city of East Lansing from the year 2006 to the present, or last year, actually. And as you can see, it's been pretty much completely static. Actually, if you look at this, there's a reduction of about $469,000 in our available funds during that same time period. So when you started to read about East Lansing's financial situation being dire, this is part of the issue that we were dealing with. So as we look at this, in normal times, there would have been a steady increase in the value of our general fund, largely because of property tax revenues within the city, but property tax revenues actually declined during this time period. So a lot of the general fund money comes from federal and state grants. So those continued to go up a little bit, but those have to be used for specific purposes. And the general fund money from property tax revenue goes towards our other purposes and has never been enough to actually pay for police and fire within the city. So we get about $16.8 million in property tax revenues on an annual basis, and our cost of public safety within the community approaches more like $20 million a year. This next slide is the pension payments during this same time frame. And this is really the crux of the financial situation that the city was faced with. Because, you know, in 2001, we were paying about $2 million a year, about a little over $2 million a year is our required annual payment for our pensions. And all of you are covered by a different pension system, a defined contribution system. I will just say, without going into detail, you have the richest defined contribution system of any community or any entity in the state of Michigan. I think you get about a 10% match or something like that. It's about nine? It's a substantial. Most matches are about 3% throughout the state. So that has been in place since the 60s, and Michigan State University was one of the leading entities to move to a defined contribution system. The rest of the state went from a defined contribution system to a defined benefit system, and that's sort of the problem, one of the problems that we have. But as you can see, our required contribution, as predicted, is going up and up and up, and our funded liability at the same time is going down because of the impact of the recession, the loss of revenue in that recession. In 1 year, 2008, we lost 25% of the value of our pension fund. So it is very difficult to come back from that. Can you go to the next slide? To answer this, before we had the income tax actually enacted, we made a decision to begin the process of trying to get to an extra $3 million a year into the pension fund. And the reason we did that is because we appointed a financial health team to analyze our situation and make recommendations to the city of East Lansing. I will say it was dominated by faculty members from Michigan State University. The recommendations that they made included the enactment of an income tax in the city, but they also recommended that we make substantial cuts to our budget going forward, just in case we did not have that revenue. So during this last budget year, we cut $1.2 million from the budget by reducing the programs that you see here. And those include reduction in public safety services and reduction of other contributions that we make to other programs within the city of East Lansing, requiring the court to reduce its payroll by $150,000. And that was helpful to us as well. And you can see the things that we did there. The next slide showed the proposal that we adopted in case the income tax did not pass in the city, which was another $2.1 million that would be cut from the budget. So the objective was $3 million to go as extra payments into the pension fund, which would reduce our obligation and keep the city steady going forward. Some of these cuts have gone in place anyway. So, as you know, the Folk Festival is not around anymore. At least it looks like it's going to stay not around for a while. And that was a $35,000 savings for us. So that is off. We are requiring the court to continue to reduce within its budget. So another $150,000 will go out of that. And we're actively engaged in conversations with the county and the city of Lansing to combine our court system, district court system, which will result in a substantial savings for the City of Lansing, the City of East Lansing, and overall for the county government as well. So we're pursuing that as we speak. I don't know when that'll come to fruition, but legislation is pending at the State House right now with regard to that. Next slide, please. But our objective overall is to get to $5 million in annual contributions because of the way this chart tracks. So if we just put $3 million in, it is very helpful to the City of East Lansing, and that was the result of a study that was done by the financial health team. Plant Moran was asked to study the impact and came up with a proposal that indicated that if the income tax was enacted, about $3 million a year could be added to this pension payment over and above our required payments. But we really would like to do $5 million because that will reduce our pension fund obligation much quicker and free up money for all of the other things that the city does and the responsibilities the city has. So what this left column shows is what if we don't do anything? Because by 2030, $12,902,000 will be our annual required payment into our pension fund. If we add $5 million on an annual basis at that same time frame, it will be $6,600,000 in annual required payment. So you can see the value of us doing this, because at $16.8 million in property tax revenue, right now we don't have enough money to pay for all of our police and fire, but at that point in time, the city will be effectively bankrupt if we don't make these changes at this point in time. Can we go to the next? This is the impact of general fund mandatory payments. The red line is, and we did not increase this, frankly, because we didn't have time to actually do the math, but the property tax revenue is expected to rise at about 1.5% on an annual basis, but this is a static line. This is the line that you saw in that chart. The blue line shows the required mandatory payments if we aren't able to make a change. The next chart shows the trajectory of that blue line if we're able to make the $5 million a year. So where does that money come from? I guess you could ask that question. If we get $3 million a year, 60% of the projected annual revenue from the income tax, that's the $3 million. In the last 2 years, we've also reached an agreement with the Board of Water and Light to receive a franchise fee for electric service within the City of East Lansing. That brings in about $1.3 million a year. And so we really are filling a gap of about $700,000. That $700,000 gap was filled by the $1.2 million that we cut from the budget this year. So that money will be captured, and we will have $5 million a year that we are able to put towards this, which, although this chart only goes to 2030, I can tell you that within a couple of years after that, we're talking about being back at the $2 million a year annual required payment that we had in 2001. So it's a very conservative approach, but an approach to make sure that the city remains financially stable. The next chart really brings us into the discussion of the income tax and its impact. This is the non-taxable income that is included in the income tax. So, you know, it's pretty standard stuff, I guess. If you are a retiree, and I don't know if anybody in here is really considered a retiree, I wouldn't imagine you're here if you are, but and I thought that professors taught till they dropped over anyway. Is that the case? So you'll be working as long as lawyers do, and I am a lawyer. So I think that I'm not sure what this impact will have on you, but I will say that if you don't live in the city of East Lansing, but you work here, you'll pay 0.5% of your income to the city of East Lansing. If you live in the city of East Lansing, can I see the hands of people who actually live in the city? All right. Thank you for living in the city. And if you live in the city, you're going to pay 1% of your income. But let me add a little caveat to that, because I know that my first chief of staff when I was in the House is sitting back here in the back of the room. And when you work at the Capitol, you know, we'd get a little chart from the clerk of the House who would say, this year we worked 179 days. That's really how your income will be calculated. So if you're working in Flint, primarily, if you're working 180 days in Flint, you're really only going to pay your 1% or 0.5% on the 180 days that you're working in the city of East Lansing. So I think that might be a question for some of you, but that is how it will be calculated. The city has been aggressively pursuing making sure that the public is fully aware of how this will impact them. So we have engaged a firm, Innovative Solutions Incorporated, to actually manage the income tax for the city of East Lansing. We are not putting employees on to manage this. We're using an outside firm that actually does the income tax for 23 other communities in the city, in the state of Michigan. And so that, I think, is a wise choice by us. They've already been engaged, and they are engaged in producing a document for employers throughout the region so that they are fully aware of what they need to do to make sure that your taxes are appropriately paid. We had a meeting with MSU administration today that ended just before I came over here.
The question shortly.
Yeah, to make certain that MSU was fully aware of what will happen. And we're going to have a series of public meetings throughout the city of East Lansing to talk about this to our citizens and inform them about how they can properly file income taxes within the city. So I've been told I got to get cranking. So if there are any...
We have a question. Maybe yep. What we should probably do is officially adjourn University Council, and then if people have questions for Mayor Meadows, they're welcome to interact with him informally after
yep,
the meeting.
That's great.
Do we have a motion to adjourn? Second? All in favor? Opposed? Meeting adjourned.